first of the Pacific and an update on the politics, the people and the issues. We welcome back Tess Newton-Cain, project leader for the Griffith Asia Institute Pacific Hub. She's a dual citizen of Vanuatu and the United Kingdom, a former lecturer in law at the University of the South Pacific, and she's lived and worked in the Pacific Islands for almost 25 years. Great to have you back, Tess.
Thank you very much, Philip. It's great to be with you again.
Last time we spoke in 2019, Scott Morrison was heading to the Pacific Islands Forum. He wasn't heading to Hawaii at that occasion, where member countries were expressing growing concern about climate change and our coal industry. 2 years on, it's still a big issue, isn't it?
Very much so. I think even with the impacts of COVID-19, which have really been in the forefront of everyone's minds, we've heard over the last year or so from numerous leaders, including Dame Meg Taylor at the Forum Secretariat and Prime Minister Bainimarama of Fiji, we've heard from a number of people that for the Pacific, they still are very clear that climate change, the impacts of climate change, are what constitute the existential threat to their security that they're dealing with.
So Australian offers aid for mitigation isn't going far enough, is it?
Well, certainly Australia is providing plenty of aid for mitigation, and they're looking at focusing on climate resilient infrastructure, and they're very much in those conversations. But I guess when the conversation shifts to issues around they're very much focused on adaptation conversations, but when it comes to talking about mitigation, when the Pacific leaders want to talk about transitioning away from coal and making serious cuts to emissions, carbon neutral positions by mid-century, Australia's not really in those conversations as things currently stand.
Tess, in the last few weeks, there's been a major rift, at least one, in the Pacific Islands Forum. Now, I understand it's facing the loss of about a third of its members. Who is withdrawing, Tess, and why?
Well, what happened, we had, after lots of delays and the hope for a face-to-face meeting, which couldn't be realised, the leaders met via Zoom in a special retreat with really just one major agenda item, and that was to select the next Secretary General to replace Dame Meg Taylor for the next period of time. Now, the Micronesian countries, so that's basically Kiribati, Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, Marshall Islands, and Nauru, had stipulated quite some time ago that their belief was that it was their turn to have a Secretary General come from that part of the Pacific.
In other words, they believed in a principle of rotation.
That's right. They referred to what was called a gentleman's agreement, that over time the Secretary General's position would be held by someone from each of the sub-regions. They pointed to the fact that only one person from Micronesia has held that position before, and they asserted that it was very much their turn.
I should explain to the listener that the forum is run by a secretariat based in Suva, and it's been headed up by General Dame Meg Taylor from PNG.
Yes, so she's come to the end of the period that she's allowed to serve, which is 6 years. And so it was always the case that either at last year or, as we actually ended up being, the beginning of this year, that a decision needed to be made as to what was going to happen next.
Now, tell me about what happened with the Zoom screening.
Well, all but one of the members was able to take part, and they were represented predominantly by their leaders of government. So a great deal of effort went into making that meeting happen. It went on for a very long time, went on well into the night, and in the end, a series of secret voting rounds was held. And the upshot of that was that the former Prime Minister of Cook Islands, Henry Puna, was designated as taking on the role of Secretary General, and he's expected to take up that position in the middle of May.
Tell me a bit about him.
Well, as he's a long-established politician in the region, he's a gentleman in his 70s, so he's been a long-time player. in national politics and in the regional space. So obviously he's he's been at plenty of Pacific Island forums as a leader, representing Cook Islands, and he obviously has a lot of political experience and a fair amount of experience on the international stage. So he's seen very much as the Polynesian candidate. There was also a candidate put forward from Tonga, although that candidate withdrew fairly early in the process. So, yes, so we have another Polynesian who will take on the role of Secretary General.
Now, Tess, the Pacific Islands Forum has or had 18 members, including Australia and New Zealand. Tell me its history. I understand it was founded in 1971.
That's right. So prior to that, what we had was the South Pacific Commission. And obviously, in those days, the island countries, most of them were still colonized. So they were still in the process of forging, you know, emerging from that colonial period. And leaders at that time, people like Ratu Mara of Fiji, and the leaders of countries like Samoa and Nauru, were very frustrated because they weren't allowed to talk about the big political things that they cared about, decolonization, getting nuclear testing out of the region and things like that. So they effectively broke away and established a separate grouping. They invited Australia and New Zealand to be part of that, but very much with a view to this being a space in which they would discuss political issues, not issues around development or projects or education. And so the South Pacific community has retained that technical function, and the Pacific Islands Forum has been more of a space for political thinking and forming regional positions on big political issues, such as climate change.
Tell me about the Treaty of Rarotonga. The collective political will of its membership has delivered that.
Yeah, so this was coming out of this the big concerns about US, British and French testing of nuclear weapons in the region, which has left a legacy that some countries are still dealing with, particularly
like the Marshall Islands.
The Marshall Islands, exactly. So as a result of that, the leaders worked together and were very much, this was a process in which Australia played a very important part to essentially come up with the Treaty of Rarotonga, which declares the Pacific as a nuclear-free zone. And obviously that caused significant tensions with countries such as France and the US. But what it does demonstrate is that when the Pacific leadership does come together around these big political challenges, that there is the capacity and the willingness to work together and establish common positions that will deliver better outcomes for the peoples of the Pacific.
Now, nuclear tests are one thing, climate change is another. So in 2018, the leaders signed the BOE Declaration. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the BOE Declaration was signed in Nauru when the leaders met there. It's signed by all 18 members of the Pacific Islands Forum, and it's essentially the newest or the most recent iteration of a security arrangement. And I think what's significant about the BOE Declaration is that it expands the concept of security beyond what we might traditionally think of as security to a much broader based human-focused security. So it takes into account things like food security and security of land, but it states very clearly, it puts very much at the center this idea that climate change or the impacts of climate change are the preeminent security threat faced by the region. And so from then on, all discussions around security are based around the what's in that declaration.
My guest is Tess Newton-Cain. Now, the walkout, what does it mean for the future of the region?
Well, it's a really important question, and the short answer is we don't really know yet. What we know is that of the five countries of the Micronesian region who said that they would leave the forum if they didn't get their way, three have now activated that process. So they've given formal notification of their intention to leave. It takes 12 months to leave the forum. So for that period of time, they are still members of the forum. They are still full members of the forum. And what we already know is that there's a lot of work going on in places like Suva and all around the place of people working at the moment in fairly sort of quiet and informal ways to see how this walkout can be deflected or basically the Micronesians can be convinced to stay.
So all is not lost and there's still plenty of time for negotiation and movement.
I think that's right, but obviously it does create something of a distraction from other things that the regional leadership needs to be focusing on, not least working out how to get out of the, or how to get recover from the huge economic impacts of COVID-19 that we've seen in the region.
COVID, in fact, has been fairly well managed in the region, hasn't it?
The health impacts have been fairly minimal. We've had a few little hotspots, and there's a bit of concern at the moment around the numbers in PNG. But generally, the health impacts have been extremely well managed, and that comes from political leaders taking very early and decisive decisions to close the borders and keep them shut.
I understand that one of the members has got 100% of cover with vaccination.
Yeah, Palau is on track to be the first country in the world to have vaccinated its entire population.
So, is there a form of vaccine diplomacy at play? Is the USA active in the Northern Pacific?
Yes, so Palau and the other compact states, so that's FSM and Marshall Islands, they've been beneficiaries of Operation Warp Speed, which is the very aggressive rollout of vaccinations that's orchestrated from the US. So they're benefiting from that. French Polynesia is already receiving vaccinations via France. Other countries are waiting on COVAX deliveries. So Solomon Islands is expecting to receive 24,000 doses through COVAX by the end of April, so which is a good start, but it really only means they can vaccinate 2% of the population.
Tess, I understand that China's in there offering its vaccine to PNG and others.
Yeah, so China has made an offer and reiterated an offer of providing vaccines to Papua New Guinea. I understand that a similar offer has also been made in Vanuatu, but as yet we've yet to hear of any Pacific Island countries taking up that offer.
Belt and Road and jabs. Now, the devastation of the tourism industry must be a huge problem.
It is. I mean, obviously some countries are more dependent on tourism than others, but certainly in countries like Fiji and Cook Islands and Vanuatu, we've seen some really big hits taken by those sectors. Fiji is particularly struggling. I think the IMF and the other analysts predicted that Fiji would see a contraction of around 20% of its economy last year.
We must pay tribute to the passing of Michael Somare.
Yes, so Michael Somare passed away in the early hours of Friday morning, and the country is currently in a period of an official period of mourning for 2 weeks. He was 84 years old, and he died of acute pancreatic cancer in Port Moresby with his family.
He was truly the father of PNG independence, wasn't he?
He was. He was, you know, he was one of the architects of independence. He was, I understand, in his youth, he was something of a political firebrand. He was, you know, came out of what was called the Bully Beef Club, which was where people got together to talk politics and, you know, read poems and you know, and plan for the future of their nation. And he worked alongside Gough Whitlam to deliver independence to Papua New Guinea in 1975.
Speaking of decolonisation, New Caledonia inches forward on its long road to independence. It's been French territory since the 1850s. Mm-hmm. And I understand that for the first time in nearly 40 years, there's a Kanak majority in government.
There is. So the government that was in place fell, which actually meant that New Caledonia couldn't take part in this leaders' meeting that we discussed previously. But the new government does have a Kanak majority, which, as you say, is something of a watershed for New Caledonia. On what we're seeing at the moment is there is a something of an impasse as to who is to lead that government. So the French High Commissioner convened a meeting of all the relevant people on Tuesday, yesterday, but they've yet to be able to resolve who should take on the presidency. So there are more talks to come on that.
Now, October's referendum, which resulted in a narrow victory against independence, mm-hmm. is the second of three. So far, no has won, but there's another referendum to be held next year.
Yes, I mean, it can be held, it could be held this year, but the likelihood is that it will be held next year. And what we've saw over the previous two is that margin is narrowing. So although the yes vote has lost on both occasions, it's increased its vote significantly from the second one over the first one. So whether that indicates what we can expect for the third one, I don't think we should go that far, but certainly it's a lot closer than we were anticipating back in 2017, for example.
Were you entitled to a vote? What would you vote?
Well, I think I would probably vote for independence. I guess my general feeling is that people should direct their own lives and that countries should, people should direct the trajectory of their countries. But I'm not entitled to a vote. There are 300,000 people in New Caledonia, and it really is for them to decide their future.
Meanwhile, in Fiji, the deportation of the University of South Pacific's Vice Chancellor has been a big story.
It has, and it's thrown another sort of, it's another thorn in the side of the regionalism project because, as you know, Philip, the USP is a regional institution. It's owned by 12 countries of the region, although its headquarters is in Suva. So the relatively new Vice-Chancellor Pal, has had a fairly rocky road pretty much since he arrived, including his uncovering of apparent mismanagement and malpractice under previous leaderships and, audit reports and the council seeking to get rid of him and him being supported by other leaders. But it sort of all came to a very unfortunate head almost at the same time as this leaders' meeting was going on, when the government of Fiji elected to deport him from Fiji, which sort of left him homeless to an extent. He's currently in Nauru, and it's been made very clear by some other leaders in the region, the president of Nauru, the prime minister of Vanuatu, and the prime minister of Samoa have all basically said, well, we own, USP belongs to us as well. You can run the university from here. You can come to Samoa, or you can come to Vanuatu, or you can come from Nauru. That's yet to be worked through by a subcommittee of the University Council as to whether his contract can be maintained on that basis.
Finally, and a brief answer, are we a good neighbour?
Australia is a very valued neighbour in the region. I think everybody is very aware of the work that Australia does. I think everybody is very aware of Australia's avowed wish to be a good neighbour. No matter who you talk to, everyone can tell you a good thing about the way Australia behaves, and everyone can tell you something that they'd like to see improved. So I think it's a work in progress.
Thank you, Tess. Tess Newton-Cain, the Good Doctor, is project leader for the Griffith Asia Institute's Pacific Hub.